This is Talk is Cheap. I'm your host, DJ Susti, on KEPW LP 97.3 FM, Eugene Peaceworks Independent Community Radio. Okay, so this, and probably for the next 3 weeks, we have Pilk coming up, so I'll have stuff for you on that. And working on getting some interviews. And don't forget to check out our news. But today, and like I say, possibly for the next 2 or 3 weeks, I've got three sections of this. What it is Roots Action had a seminar on the People's Campaign, which is Martin Luther King's campaign to take money from military spending and use it to help the poor. Kind of a wacky, zany idea, but you know, it would probably work. A trillion dollar defense budget would go a long ways to helping the poor, and maybe we should get our priorities straight. And it would keep the money, it would spread the money out instead of keeping it in the hands of a small oligarchical elite. So, and this features several heavy hitters in the alternative news media, Norman Solomon, Daniel Ellsberg. There's actually two parts that turn into 3 hours, which I didn't do, so I'm giving you the most latest one that was near Martin Luther King Day. All right, so that's coming up. So, and just a word, what I'm trying to do with this show is bring you solutions, but I'm also trying to show you what's available, narrow down what's available on the web to educate yourself on what is really going on. And you know, there's usually someone. I went to meet up with some students from the Student Insurgent, and one of the things that came up in the meeting was they're having hope issues. They have no hope, and this is something that the media does on purpose. Because what do you do when you have no hope? Right, you spend money. So it's a scam. There are solutions. The longer we wait, the worse those solutions will be. But the world is not going to end, and there are people with solutions. You just have to seek them out, because the media is not going to tell you where they are. So that's one of the things I'm trying to do with this show, is bring you people that are doing something about it, even if it might be some low-level vandalism. That's kind of my breaking point, because to me, if poverty isn't violence, then vandalism certainly isn't violence. But so as long as the FCC, I don't do anything to break FCC rules, but that would be the edge. Usually they're positive solutions, people working on, you know, and this is an example. So here's another example is Maxine Waters has this bill before Congress that no one knows about because the media is not promoting it. And it's a long shot, I admit, but it would be an act of Congress that would make housing vouchers an entitlement program, just like unemployment, or just like food stamps. So, and it's a long shot, but let's face it, let's think about this. If you had 1 million people write letters to Congress in a country of 300 million people, you know, you could start a movement and possibly get something like that passed, but nobody knows about it, and the mainstream media doesn't promote it. So, it's not hopeless. There are people working on solutions. We've known the solutions for years. Martin Luther King knew the solution, what is it, over 50 years ago. We spend way too much money on the military, and that money is an extractive, linear system rather than a cyclical system that could easily be switched to a cycle where no one is ultra rich and no one is ultra poor. It's all doable. We've known how to do it for years. And we know who is the problem, is the elite multinational corporations. So, like I say, that's coming up here. I heard that the dodo is, they want to bring back the dodo. And I think we've got, you know, one other thing is, I believe, from my sustainability standpoint, you know, there's a book called Diet for a Small Planet with that's Frances Moore LePay, and in one of those books by Frances Moore LePay, she talks about Bangladesh, how its absentee ownership is why they can't just build a few dams to channel the water. Instead, it all just goes straight into the ocean instead of channeling it and making it an estuary. And I believe that man is here to enhance nature, not conquer it, but we do have the ability to enhance nature. And so, like I say, if we can do something like just build a few small dams and create an estuary of life, I would be for that. So, and it just creates a mud pile, and there's probably something lurking in that mud, but we could have a lot more life if we just enhanced the estuary. You know, that's why you'll hear me advocate things like building a space elevator rather than launching rockets into space. And they're talking about bringing back the dodo. Wouldn't it have been nice if we had enhanced nature instead of destroying it? Then there might be a second type of dodo. Who knows? Anyway, I digress. So, coming up, very important. The solution's there. The Poor People's Campaign. Military spending. No. Social welfare spending. Yes. Keynesian economics. Yes. Milton Friedman. No. Milton Friedman has not been proven to be correct. Supply-side economics does not work. Keynesian economics has been vetted through... I lived with... grow up on Milton Friedman. They vetted him through the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal. Keynes has been proven to work, and they vetted him through academia. And, you know, if you don't want socialism... pay people a proper amount of money, and if you don't want to be regulated, don't exploit people in the environment, and you won't be regulated. And so Keynes, until business takes over, you need to put stuff in on the bottom until business can figure out a way to make it work, which it's questionable whether they ever can. All right, so thanks for listening. Tell your friends. Support independent media.
Good evening to our participants and our esteemed panelists who have gathered here this evening to honor and celebrate Dr. King's profound moral courage and humanitarian justice in his opposition to war and nuclear weapons. Dr. King Jr. devoted his entire life to ending the entrenched segregation of his people and adopting a nonviolent resistance to achieve equal rights for Black Americans, for which he earned the Nobel Peace Prize in 1964. But it's also important to note that he was an anti-war leader who fought for a nuclear-free world and disarmament. In an interview with Ebony Magazine in 1957, Dr. King said, and I quote, "I definitely feel that the development and use of nuclear weapons of war should be banned. It cannot be disputed that a full-scale nuclear war would be utterly catastrophic. Hundreds and millions of people would be killed outright by the blast and heat and by the ionizing radiation produced at the instant of an explosion." In 1958, Dr. King signed a petition from SANE, a National Committee for a SANE Nuclear Policy, to halt nuclear bomb tests. The following year, in 1959, he spoke at the War Resisters League's annual dinner about the dangers of nuclear war and nuclear weapons. And in February of 1968, Dr. King, while taking the stage to address the second mobilization of the clergy and faith leaders concerned about Vietnam, urged an end to the war and warned that if the United States used nuclear weapons in Vietnam, the earth would be transformed into an inferno hard to envision. In his mission for justice, he often made a connection between Black freedom and the need for nuclear disarmament. He said, "It is a wonderful thing to work to integrate lunch counters, public accommodations, and schools, but it would be rather absurd to work to get schools and lunch counters integrated and not be concerned with the survival of a world in which to integrate." Before we begin tonight's program, I'd like to take the privilege and also recognize my countrywomen and countrymen in Iran, who, in the quest for a democratic country, have been risking their lives. Many of them are now imprisoned, and many have been shot and executed. But I would also like to recognize our native leader, Judith LeBlanc, who will lead us into tonight's discussion with a prayer and bless us on a stolen land in which we reside. Judith is an enrolled member of Caddo Nation of Oklahoma, the Native Organizers Alliance, which is a national Native training and organizing network that provides Native organizers, tribal governments, and nonprofits training based on traditional Indigenous knowledge, values, and practices. Judith co-chaired the May 2016 Fertile Ground Planning Committee and co-edited the Fertile Ground, the second edition, Growing the Seeds of Native American Health Final Report. Judith is currently working with tribal governments, traditional elders, and Native community groups in South Dakota who are organizing to protect the hydroscope. Judith, please take it away. You're muted.
I'm very glad to be here and to unmute at the appropriate moment. So my name is Judith LeBlanc. I'm a citizen of the Caddo Nation. I'm also the executive director of the Native Organizers Alliance, which is a over decade old Native network that was born out of the struggles to mobilize grassroots Native support for Obamacare. Once the Indian Health Improvement Act was rolled into Obamacare, it became necessary for Indian country to get organized. And I was, 8 years ago actually, I was the field director for Peace Action. And then during the Bush administration, I was the co-chair of United for Peace and Justice. And it really struck me how important it is that we understand all things in relationship. I will offer some words of encouragement. In Indian country, that's how we open our meetings, either with a prayer or words of encouragement. And of course, it's been somewhat of a new development in the movements to also start with some kind of an acknowledgement of the place on which we stand. We have such responsibilities to the place where we stand, which is Mother Earth. It really struck me, though, when I was active in the Iraq anti-war movement, how important it is to see not only all things in relationship, but how important it is to weave together the struggle for disarmament, nuclear disarmament, and against militarism with the struggle to protect Mother Earth from climate destruction, from the exploitation and degradation of fossil fuel extraction. And to make the connection between the whole cycle of militarism. And for one of my experiences in the anti-Iraq war movement was during a United Nations Non-Proliferation Treaty conference, where I invited some of my relatives to speak who had been working for many, many years on the Laguna Pueblo and on the Navajo Reservation against uranium mining and in responding to the long-term crisis that uranium mining had caused on the land and for the health and well-being of Navajo and Pueblo communities in the Southwest. And it really struck me during that NPT conference how for many people in the nuclear disarmament movement, they understood that uranium mining had affected Native communities. But then, as now, many people could not even fathom how important Native leadership, Indigenous leadership is in this struggle to save the planet from militarism. And the fact remains that many of the land acknowledgments that are made in good spirit with good intention often paint Native peoples as peoples of the past, when in fact, all of the major climate justice struggles and for over a decade have been led and initiated by Indigenous Native tribal communities. Many of them winning struggles, such as stopping the drilling in the Arctic. Well, one thing that is for sure, that if we do not in the nuclear disarmament and anti-militarism movements weave together the struggle to protect Mother Earth with ending militarism, we will not be on firm ground. If we do not develop authentic relationships with the communities that are affected by militarism from its very starting point of the mining of uranium, then we will not have a movement that has long-term impact on the future. I think that one of the biggest contributions to the political moment at this stage of the crisis that we're all facing is that there is a relationship between the past and the future, and that from an Indigenous framework, to understand the future, you have to learn the lessons of the past. But in an Indigenous time frame, a time cosmology, the only place where the past and the future come together is in the present. And therefore, how we walk in the present, how we make the connections between all things, and to understand the interrelationships, it's the biggest element of our collective ancestral responsibilities to protect Mother Earth and to end militarism. You know, we've been in a sustained period of many crises, the pandemic, wars, aggression, the ascendancy of the right wing. But at the same time, we've experienced some of the most important magic movement moments of our lifetime. When you think about the movement for Black lives, or the migrant youth, the dreamers, or the fast food workers, and the struggles for a living decent wage, or Standing Rock, where for the first time in history, hundreds of tribes came together, 10,000 people came together to stand as one, stand with our values to protect Mother Earth. And then you look at how things have played out in the electoral arena, with massive historic turnouts in 2020, because people understood what the impact of a right-wing extremist ascendancy could mean for our future. Or you look at the turnout in the 2022 elections, where a majority of people voted against crazy right-wing extremist crazies. Yet we still have so far to go. And from our vantage point in Indian country, the movements that are alive and well at the grassroots are the basis for hope. But from the standpoint of Indian country, if we are going to end militarism, then we have to understand the past. We have to accept the ancestral responsibility of what militarism has done from the very beginnings of the United States. With that understanding, there is power. With that understanding, then we understand how one period of history has led into the next, but also what the future could hold if in the present we walk with an understanding that all things are related, that Indigenous peoples and all people of color and poor communities and the communities of those who have become clear-sighted on the impact of militarism on our lives and the struggle for a multiracial democracy. And so I look forward to the conversation tonight, but I also think that there has to be a broad-based struggle to reflect on the fact that nuclear disarmament and ending militarism is a political issue. Ending militarism, ending the threat of nuclear war is a is a moral concern, as Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King admonished us. But in the final analysis, ending militarism and the threat of nuclear war is an ancestral responsibility that we must take up in a way that is different. This is not your grandma's peace movement. This is a movement that needs to be built because the right wing is on the ascendancy. And the only way forward is to build massive movements of the majority. The majority right now, as it stands, is clear on the need for action on climate. It's the majority in this country are clear on the impact and the effects of systemic racism. The majority are clear on the fact that democracy, a multiracial democracy, deserves to be protected, to fulfill many of the dreams of our ancestors. And so I will just end with these words of encouragement to say that there's no fear of the future as long as we're walking on a good path in the present and we accept our ancestral responsibilities for that future. Thank you.
But thank you, Judith. And please do share your website with our attendees and let us know how we can collaborate further with you. I just want to recognize also that just recently, 3 Black men were killed brutally by the Los Angeles PD, and our heart goes out to their families. I want to recognize our next speaker as someone who, if he did not have this vision for the Diffused Nuclear War Project, none of this would be possible. I get to work with this colleague of mine every single day, and this is something that I take full advantage of, and it is an honor of a lifetime. It is my privilege to introduce Norman Solomon, who is the National Director of RootsAction.org. He is the author of dozens of books, including War Made Easy, How Presidents and Pundits Keep Spinning Us to Death. He was a Bernie Sanders delegate from California to the 2016 and 2020 Democratic National Convention. He is also the founder and executive director of the Institute for Public Accuracy. Take the floor, please, Norman.
Many people have made our gathering possible here, and you know, I feel a deep appreciation for all who have done the work and have laid the groundwork for progressive movements now, at which diffuse nuclear war is a small, very small, but important part. We've all heard, I think, just about any adult or even a school child in the United States has heard the phrase, "I have a dream." Very few have heard the phrase, "the madness of militarism." But both of those phrases came from Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. So what does it tell us about the corporate media and the politics of this country that we often hear about, "I have a dream," and so rarely hear about the madness of militarism? And I was thinking today about, if you take those four words, actually, a dozen words, incorporating them would be terrific. I have a dream for us to end the madness of militarism. And yet, the militarism that is so pervasive hardly gets mentioned in the mass media. It's a deep bipartisan problem. And I think that progressive forces often have trouble being explicit and emphatic about that. We know that when it comes to what gets called domestic issues, there are huge, profound differences between the Republican and Democratic parties. But what about nuclear weapons? What about militarism? It's really hard to see a difference. This is an omnicidal, bipartisan push to spend now $2 trillion or so to invest. Obama's idea, Trump's idea, Biden's idea. And yet somehow we're supposed to go easy on the Democrats when they are partners with the Republicans in Congress and in the White House to push this country further along to cooperate with other nuclear powers to plan to end human life on Earth, essentially, 99% or so from nuclear winter, we're told by the scientists. This siloing and the separation of issues, of course, as we know, that's not how the real world works. When I was growing up, I heard Ron Dellums, at one point, the chair of the Congressional Black Caucus, say that nuclear weapons are an equal opportunity destroyer. And yet the segregation, if you will, of issues has really, from corporate media, from the arms manufacturers, from the bipartisan consensus on Capitol Hill, really fragmented our awareness, as though this isn't one world. And yet, though, of course, we know this is one world, the sphere that we all live on, including, as we know now, if we didn't before, about climate, about COVID, about all the ways that we're bound together. So I just want to sum up my presentation by saying that, of course, the analysis is crucial, and of course, the action is crucial. And I just love working with so many different individuals and organizations for organizing, because if we don't organize effectively, then we're going to be crushed by the military-industrial corporate intelligence media complex that is supremely organized. They're really well organized. And Diffuse Nuclear War is another effort to help build coalitions. And I want to encourage everybody watching, listening, if you haven't already, to go to diffusenuclearwar.org and sign up, because this is an information coalition. It's also an action coalition. In October, Diffuse Nuclear War organized about 50 different picket lines around the United States in coordination and cooperation and mutual work with many groups around the country. 50 picket lines at senatorial and congressional offices around the country to strongly urge that finally members of Congress acknowledge publicly not only the crisis and the dangers of nuclear war, but also that they speak up to do something about it, which is really, of course, crucial. And later in our gathering here, we're going to hear from Ryan Black, who will tell more about the plans from Diffuse Nuclear War in the weeks ahead for a campaign that will be national, that will be messaging members of Congress, and will be messaging them with words and with photographs of our loved ones, and to help build a movement to pressure those in Congress and in the White House to end the madness of militarism.
Thank you so much, Norman. And we look forward to hearing from Ryan Black at the end of our program here. We have also extended an invitation to Pastor Mike McBride, who will be joining us later. But what I will do now, for the sake of time, is I will move over to David Swanson, another wonderful colleague of mine, who is an author, activist, journalist, and a radio host. David is the executive director of worldbeyondwar.org and a campaign coordinator for rootsaction.org. David Swanson's books include War is a Lie. He blogs at davidswanson.org and warisacrime.org. He hosts a Talk World Radio, and he is a Nobel Peace Prize nominee and U.S. Peace Prize recipient. David, I know you have some wonderful slides that you've put together for us, so let us share your screen and go from there.
Can you see it okay?
Yeah.
So thank you very much, Anya, and everyone else for being here and for including me. See if I can get it to go to the next slide. I can't. So we know the risks. They are no secret. The doomsday clock has almost nowhere to go but oblivion. We know what's needed. We've made a national holiday of a man who said he would oppose all nukes and all wars without any regard to whether it was popular, who said the choice was between nonviolence and non-existence. We are so aware of what's needed that we all routinely tell our kids to be radical peacemakers, to de-escalate, to back away, to apologize, to compromise. We know what war is, and at long last, with white, Christian, European victims to blame on Russia, we see its images in the news media. We also finally hear what it costs financially. But we hear what it costs financially, not in terms of the trade-offs of the human and environmental good far greater than ending war that could be done with the funding now spent on war. Rather, in the ridiculous terms of spending money, including on human and environmental needs, somehow being an evil in itself. Victims of war are presented not as reasons to end war, but as reasons to continue war. Guidance you would give to children is widely shunned. In fact, it's tantamount to treason to even suggest the sort of wise steps one would insist on children learning. In our government, a tiny group of right-wingers actually exercise power for the good of cutting military spending combined with the evil of cutting human and environmental spending. And some of those who supposedly care about the future of life on Earth find that worthy of mockery. The value of the day is inaction. The supreme attribute is cowardice. So-called progressives inside and outside of Congress support endless mountains of weapons shipments to keep a war going, to starve children who need those same resources, and to heighten the risk of nuclear apocalypse, while making the quietest little self-contradictory peeps about negotiating peace. And when anyone objects to that, these progressives run screaming from their own shadows or blame a staffer for the misunderstanding that they ever meant to attempt anything at all. MLK Day should be a day for courage, for independence, for nonpartisanship, and for nonviolent action, for the complete ending and abolishing of participation in any war. The right wing in the U.S. government will not cut war spending without public pressure. Those claiming to oppose the right wing will place that very opposition above the task of making peace in the absence of tremendous, principled, and independent public pressure. So we have to ask ourselves, what do we oppose more? Hunger or Republicans? The destruction of all life on Earth or Republicans? War or Republicans? We can oppose many things properly prioritized. We can even do so through uncomfortably large coalitions. We don't need vegetarians between meals or peace advocates between wars or between Democratic presidencies. We need a principled stand for peace precisely in time of overwhelming war propaganda. It is worth remembering that a reasonable agreement was reached at Minsk in 2015, that the current president of Ukraine was elected in 2019, promising peace negotiations, and that the US and right-wing groups in Ukraine pushed back against that. It's worth remembering that Russia's demands prior to its invasion of Ukraine were perfectly reasonable and a better deal from Ukraine's perspective than anything discussed since. The US has also been a force against negotiations during the past 10 months. Medea Benjamin and Nicholas Davies wrote in September, quote, "For those who say negotiations are impossible, we have only to look at the talks that took place during the first month after the Russian invasion, when Russia and Ukraine tentatively agreed to a 15-point peace plan in talks mediated by Turkey. Details still had to be worked out, but the framework and the political will were there. Russia was ready to withdraw from all of Ukraine, except for Crimea and the self-declared republics in Donbas. Ukraine was ready to renounce future membership in NATO and adopt a position of neutrality between Russia and NATO. The agreed framework provided for political transitions in Crimea and Donbas that both sides would accept and recognize based on self-determination for the people of the regions. The future security of Ukraine was to be guaranteed by a group of other countries, but Ukraine would not host foreign military bases on its territory." On March 27th, President Zelensky told a national TV audience, "Our goal is obvious, peace and the restoration of normal life in our native state as soon as possible." He laid out his red lines for the negotiations on TV to reassure his people he would not concede too much, and he promised them a referendum on the neutrality agreement before it would take effect. Ukrainian and Turkish sources have revealed that the UK and US governments played decisive roles in torpedoing those early prospects for peace. During UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson's surprise visit to Kiev on April 9th, he reportedly told Prime Minister Zelensky that the UK was in it for the long run, that it would not be party to any agreement between Russia and Ukraine, and that the collective West saw a chance to press Russia and was determined to make the most of it. The same message was reiterated by U.S. Defense Secretary Austin, who followed Johnson to Kiev on April 25th and made it clear the U.S. and NATO were no longer just trying to help Ukraine defend itself, but were now committed to using the war to weaken Russia. Turkish diplomats told retired British diplomat Craig Murray that these messages from the U.S. and U.K. killed their otherwise promising efforts to mediate a ceasefire and a diplomatic resolution. How can you tell that someone does not want peace? They carefully avoid it. Both sides in this war propose preconditions for peace talks that they know the other side will not accept. And when one side calls for a ceasefire for 2 days, the other side doesn't call their bluff and propose one for 4 days, choosing instead to ridicule it. Once we understand that the path to peace is not war and that peace is available through compromise if governments want it, what can we do? So here are some upcoming actions that will have as big an impact as we make them have. I hope to see you all at many of them, as many of them as possible, and you will be emailed this presentation and can find all of these events at worldbeyondwar.org.
Peace. You're listening to Roots Action Seminar on Martin Luther King's People's Campaign on KPW LP 97.3 FM, Eugene Peaceworks, Independent Community Radio.
Peace.
Thank you so much, David. And if you would then mind sharing your Twitter handle and the websites that you mentioned in the chat for our audience to benefit from, we would greatly appreciate it. I cannot tell you enough how much I just am delighted to have this next speaker, not only as someone that someone who mentors me, but someone who is always on a mission to do good. I know that throughout the Iran uprising, he has been one of the very few who has reached out to me on a number of occasions just to say hello and how can I help. So it is my absolute honor and privilege to introduce to you Khoury Peterson Smith, my dear friend, who I actually spent a good half hour to an hour yesterday talking to about what our next campaign should be about in terms of peace. Khoury is the Michael Ratner Middle East Fellow at Institute for Policy Studies. He researches the U.S. empire, borders, and migration, and he graduated from the Clark University Graduate School of Geography in Massachusetts after completing a dissertation that focused on militarization and sovereignty. He is one of the co-authors and organizers of the 2015 Black Solidarity with the Palestine Movement, which was signed by over 1,100 Black activists, artists, and scholars. I know that, Khoury, in our conversations, oftentimes we talk about cross-generational activism. And can you tie that to the Dr. King's quest for a better world, as well as the Black struggle?
I'd be honored to. I'm so grateful to join you all. And I want to say a word about some of the things that Henya just mentioned. I want to say a word about war today, and I want to say a word about Dr. King. But I want to start by talking about the fact that this year marks the 20th anniversary of the most recent U.S. invasion of Iraq. And it should be a real year of reflection for all of us and interrogation of what the U.S. did and what the U.S. continues to do. And it is a time when certainly the people of Iraq are on my mind in a big way. And I also want to acknowledge the resistance that that exploded 20 years ago all around the world, including this country, to challenge that invasion. And I do want to say that while I'm deeply grateful to be here with all of my fellow panelists, I want to especially honor the work of Judith and Norman and David, who played such important roles in shaping that resistance, enormous roles in shaping that anti-war protest era. And that certainly impacted me and many others. So with that, I do want to say a word about War Today, and say that as for many people in this country and around the world, my heart is with the people of Ukraine as they go toward another year of a horrendous invasion. And my heart is with all the people of the world who are suffering from war, the people of Palestine, the people of Somalia, the people of Ethiopia. Unfortunately, I could keep going. There are so many people facing the horrendous violence of war and of displacement and so on. About Russia and Ukraine, I want to be crystal clear that I reject entirely Russia's invasion, but that does not mean that I accept the US's involvement in this war. And I urge critical interrogation of US involvement. And I want to say, really kind of echoing what David said, that I think that we are in an extremely dangerous situation, actually, where the United States government for nearly a year has reaped the benefits of war, that is the benefits that come with a powerful country involved in a war, things like national unity to the extent that that's possible in the United States at the moment, things like a bump in the president's approval rating, things like, of course, a boon for the US weapons industry. It has reaped these benefits and with zero risk at all. It is not Americans who are dying, even though the White House and Congress can find seemingly endless billions of dollars for weapons. And it seems like there's no talk of any kind of end game. The US can just keep on fueling the war, keep on or fueling one end of the war, keep on sending weapons and so on with no sacrifice of American life. And that's an extremely dangerous situation that I think we really need to challenge. Really, this year, again, thinking about 20 years since the US invasion of Iraq, or coming, this is a couple of years after 20 years of the US invasion of Afghanistan. This is around 20 years since the US operations in Yemen and Somalia, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. This should really be a time of reflection on the catastrophe of war and militarism, and in particular on the US's role in all of that. Instead, I think that the US is taking the opportunity, taking the occasion of this war in Ukraine to prepare for more war. It is a new round of militarization, more weapons, higher military budgets, with Washington leading the way, but with many other countries in the world following suit. What could be happening, what should be happening, you know, we know that at some point this war will end through a negotiated settlement. It's a question of when it will happen. But it is the case that the United States actually doesn't have to wait for the for Ukraine to have its own negotiations with Russia, because while nothing, absolutely nothing can justify this Russian invasion, it is the case that the US has militarized Europe for decades. By stationing troops, by stationing nuclear weapons, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So for the sake of the people of Europe, for the sake of the people of the world, and to deny Putin any basis, however cynical, to justify his actions, the United States can lead not through war making, but through demilitarization. The United States can say, okay, we will pull troops out of Eastern Europe. We will take nuclear weapons out, et cetera, et cetera. We know, of course, you know, it's painfully clear after another year of this, that the US government will not lead on that, we are called, the people of this country are called to demand that kind of thing. Now with that, I want to turn to Dr. King. And you know, it is the case, of course, and folks on this call will know that Dr. King was anti-war, that anti-militarism was central to his outlook and his work. But we don't talk enough in this country, when we talk about Dr. King's legacy, about his internationalism, which goes beyond simply opposing war, as important as that is. King saw the Black freedom struggle in this country in the context of global freedom struggle. And I want to read just a little bit from his incredible letter from Birmingham Jail, written in 1963. He said, "Oppressed people cannot remain oppressed forever. The urge for freedom will eventually come. This is what has happened to the American Negro. Something within has reminded him of his birthright of freedom. Something without has reminded him that he can gain it. Consciously and unconsciously, he has been swept in by what Germans call the zeitgeist. And with all his Black brothers of Africa, his brown and yellow brothers of Asia, South America, and the Caribbean, he is moving with a sense of cosmic urgency toward the promised land of racial justice." And so here we have King in jail in Alabama, thinking about and talking about a Black freedom struggle in the context of a global decolonization struggle. We know that King was inspired by the struggle in India. We learned that he was inspired by Gandhi, but without seeing Gandhi in context of an anti-colonial struggle against British Empire. That is what King was inspired by. Dr. King was present at the independence of Ghana, the inauguration of Ghana as an independent state in Africa. So this was part of his landscape. This is what he drew upon. And I think, and I'll say this in closing, that King organized and thought and engaged with the belief in the power of people around the world freeing themselves, that capacity of people to free themselves. And I think that this helped, it grounded his opposition to US militarism, because US militarism is presented as a solution to the world's problems. But King, like all internationalists, saw that the people of the world are capable of solving their own problems through their heroic resistance and an amazing time of resistance that he was living in. So as the people of Ukraine endure and survive and resist, and as the people of Palestine resist a new round of Israeli violence, as the people of Iran fight for freedom, we would do well to not only challenge the militarism of the US government, even when that militarism is popular, perhaps especially when that militarism is popular, do we need to challenge it. But we would also do well to take a page from Dr. King's book and engage and learn with the freedom fighters of the world. Thank you.
Thank you, Khoury, for that beautiful, beautiful remark.
Said to me,
brought to you by Silt River Tree Museum and Casino, built on the site where an actual ancient rainforest once stood See a full-scale replica of a Douglas fir tree. See pictures of trees larger in diameter than a man is tall. Trout and salmon that once choked the rivers of the Northwest will sing to you in our chamber of taxidermy. Hear the disaffected sounds of Feller Buncher and his bunch of fellers, an all-ex-logger band, in our simulated wood amphitheater. Take the Oregon Desert Highway to the clear-cut road exit, turn right at the stump in the road, and you're at Silt River Tree Museum and Casino. Free parking, kids a buck and a half, closed during summer months due to melting asphalt, giant locusts, and methyl ethyl hydroxy colchicine slag emissions.